Hello, welcome to the Gemma Podcast, Season 2. Avid listeners might recognize that I'm a new voice. That's right, I'm not Chance Spencer. My name is Odysseus Quarles, and I will be your new host for the second season of the Gemma Podcast. Like Chance, I am also a Gemma intern at the Gemini Observatory. The Gemma program stands for Gemini in the Era of Multi-Messenger Astronomy, and is funded by a multi-million dollar award from the National Science Foundation in order to advance the leadership role of Gemini Observatory in this new era of multi-messenger astronomy. It was designed to maximize synergies with the transformative facilities that are coming online in the near future, such as the Vera C. Rubin Observatory, or ones that are already active, like LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. The projects within GEMMA focus specifically on high-resolution time-domain astronomy and outreach. Every year, in the first week of March, Gemini Observatory hosts the Journey Through the Universe program. Journey Through the Universe brings astronomers and their expertise into K-12 classrooms on the Big Island of Hawaii, and in 2020, for the first time ever, to classrooms on Maui as well. As another part of Journey Week, Gemini Observatory hosts and facilitates a number of public talks by top experts. This year, we were lucky to have one of our returning experts and classroom educators, Brian Day, speak about his work. Brian Day is the lead for citizen science and community development at SSERVI, NASA's Solar System Exploration Research Virtual Institute. Brian's team at SSERVI created a series of virtual solar system treks available at treks.nasa.gov, where anyone can explore the surfaces of Mercury, Mars, Earth's moon, Saturn's moon Titan, and the large asteroids Ceres and Vesta. Brian is an expert in one of the least considered aspects when we talk about multi-messenger astronomy. Many people are starting to be aware of how we can probe our universe with gravitational waves and cosmic rays, but one of the most powerful and well-known tools available to astronomers is, in fact, one of the oldest fields of multi-messenger astronomy. While telescopes, cosmic rays, and gravitational waves let us peer into the oldest, most distant corners of our universe, there's an equally exciting region of space that astronomers can explore much more directly. Our own solar system. Since the 1960s, NASA and other space agencies around the world have been sending probes to the moons and planets nearest to us. We've even sent people to walk on and study our nearest celestial neighbor, the moon. Robotic and human exploration provides us with another messenger to add to our toolkit, and is the only method that lets astronomers conduct direct experiments on what we study. Brian has worked on a scientist and outreach lead on multiple robotic missions to other worlds in our solar system, including LADEE, the Lunar Atmosphere and Dust Environment Explorer, and LCROSS, the Lunar Crater Observation and Sensing Satellite. Now, let's listen to Brian Day's talk about the history and future of lunar exploration and NASA's plan to send the first humans to Mars.
Actually, right now is a very exciting time as we start thinking about going back to the moon. We're also celebrating the anniversary of Apollo. This past year, we had the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing on the moon, and there are now a succession of 50th anniversary Apollo events. But Apollo really was an inflection point in human history. It really, in a lot of ways, redefined how we saw ourselves, the universe, and our place in the universe. But it's only appropriate, as we think about Apollo, to look back at the predecessors to Apollo, how we got there. And there were a number of robotic precursors to Apollo. That included the Ranger spacecraft that did dives right into the surface of the moon, photographing all the way down. The Lunar Surveyor spacecraft, 7 robotic spacecraft that successfully soft landed on the moon and sent back data and proved that you could land on the moon without sinking into thick dust. The Lunar Orbiters, 5 orbiters that went into orbit around the moon and mapped the surface prior to our sending humans there. We also had crewed vehicles. We started out with the Project Mercury, 6-man flights with single seater, a Volkswagen Bug would be luxurious compared to this. Then we did Gemini, 2 people, and this worked out the whole concept of rendezvous and docking that was going to be so critical in the Apollo missions. There was also something called the X-15, which was not really a precursor to Apollo, but more of a precursor to the space shuttle. This was our first space plane. It was a hypersonic aircraft that actually flew into space, and a number of pilots did get their astronaut wings flying the X-15. Oh, I should point out that one of the X-15 test pilots was a guy named Neil Armstrong, who comes into our story a little bit later. So the Apollo mission was quite a big step from its predecessors, much bigger, much more capable, much larger launch vehicle. And the whole concept was taking off from here on Earth, going into orbit around the moon. Astronauts then went into a smaller spacecraft that they had carried with them. They separated, turned around, docked with it, transferred into the lunar module. The lunar module then separated, would go down and land. Gee, what could possibly go wrong? And so there were a series of Apollo missions. The first Apollo mission, Apollo 7, commanded by one of our Mercury heroes. So Wally Schirra was the commander of this. And this was just the test of the Apollo spacecraft itself. It went into orbit, and everybody got sick. They all came down with head colds. They were told that they had to put on their helmets. There was a bit of a rebellion. Nobody felt well. It was kind of a grumpy flight. But it did demonstrate that the Apollo did work. Apollo 8, this was an amazingly memorable event. This is the first time that humans actually got to the moon. We did an orbit around the moon, or we orbited around the moon. They went into orbit around the moon on Christmas Eve of 1968. And there was something just absolutely amazing about sitting in front of the TV that Christmas Eve and seeing the lunar landscape just rolling beneath you in the TV screen. It was haunting. It was amazing. Apollo 9 was then the test of the lunar module, and that was done in Earth orbit. Apollo 10 was an exercise in extreme frustration, I would imagine, because the astronauts on Apollo 10 went into orbit around the moon, got into the lunar module, separated, and started their descent, and then turned around and came back. They were not to land. They were just to do those steps up to landing. The lunar module was named Snoopy. We got a lot of mileage out of that. Afterwards, Snoopy was jettisoned to go into solar orbit, never be seen again. But just recently, some people with some big telescopes think they may have recovered Snoopy. And that brings a whole new meaning to the phrase, Snoopy come home. Apollo 11 is where it really happened. 1969. Everything changed. And Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin stepped onto the surface of the moon, while Michael Collins remained in orbit, alone circling the moon. On their way down, Neil and Buzz had their spacecraft being guided down by its fairly primitive computer. And Neil looked out the window and saw that the spacecraft was going long, and it was coming down in a crater with great big house-sized boulders. And he quickly realized, we can't land there. So he took manual control and continued flying onward, looking for a smooth place to land. And with only 25 seconds of fuel remaining, found a place and set down. And Houston radioed up, you got a bunch of guys about to turn blue here. Apollo 12, this was a demonstration of being able to do a pinpoint landing. And so they landed in Oceanus Procellarum, a big, vast, flat sea of basaltic lava. And they set down right next to the robotic Surveyor 3 spacecraft. And as they walked to a number of impact craters gathering samples of material that had been excavated, they also walked up to the Surveyor 3 spacecraft, removed some of the electronics, and brought them home to see how long-duration exposure to hard radiation had affected those electronics. Apollo 13 was the mission that almost ended in disaster. On the way to the moon, a liquid oxygen tank exploded and brought the mission into great peril. Through a great deal of skill on the part of the astronauts and ingenuity on the part of the ground crew, the astronauts were able to do a swing around the moon and have the moon's gravity return them to the Earth, and they landed safely. Apollo 14 was commanded by Alan Shepard, our very first astronaut. And there are a couple of really interesting, there are a number of interesting things that happened with Apollo 14, but I'll just tell two of them. One of them was that on the edge of a crater called Cone Crater, they saw a rock about the size and shape of a football. That rock was later named Big Bertha. But the rock was brought back home and was found to be a breccia, a type of rock consisting of many different types of rock that had been welded together by the heat and energy of a meteorite impact. And just recently, a number of the rocks within Big Bertha were analyzed, and one of them told a really amazing story. As it was analyzed, the rock seemed to tell us that it was not from the moon at all. That rock actually came from the Earth. It was formed 4.1 billion years ago, over 12 miles down. But back then, in the earliest days of the solar system, it was a pretty violent place, and there were a lot of big asteroid impacts. And a large asteroid hit the Earth in that area and blasted a great deal of material off the surface and into space, including this rock. The rock traveled through space, and it landed on the moon. But it didn't get to rest there peacefully very long, because 3.9 billion years ago, another asteroid comes, slams into the moon, creates Mare Imbrium, and from the standpoint of our little rock, it sees this great tsunami of hot, molten stuff coming over the northern horizon and burying it, and cooking it, and welding it to the local moon rock. And there it should have remained buried for all time, except for 26 million years ago, another smaller asteroid comes, slams into the ground, blasts a hole called Cone Crater, and our little rock ends up lying out on the surface. And then in 1971, Alan Shepard comes along, looks at it, goes, I like that rock, picks it up, puts it in his bag, brings it back home. As a result, we now have the oldest Earth rock that we have ever seen, that we've ever been able to study, and it was kept and preserved for us on the moon. One other Apollo 14 story I'll tell is that Alan was a golf fan. He loved playing golf. Now, there were very, very big rules against carrying any contraband onto an Apollo spacecraft. Every single ounce had to be accounted for. But Alan knew that he was a space hero. He knew this was his last flight. And he knew they probably weren't going to fire him. So, at the end of the mission, toward the end of their last EVA, they've got the TV camera set up and it's broadcasting to the Earth, and he goes and walks behind the lunar module and he comes back out, and he had brought the head of one of his irons, his golf irons, and he had attached it to the handle of one of the retrieval tools. And he comes walking out with his golf club, pulls out a golf ball, drops it into the dust there, takes a swing, and hits more dust than ball, and gets a little bit of derision from the folks back at Houston. Fortunately, he had another ball, puts that down, whacks it, and announces miles and miles and miles. Apollo 15 landed on the edge of Mare Imbrium, right near the Apennine Mountains. And this was a chance to sample not just the smooth, younger Mare material, but hopefully actually get some of the much older, ancient highland material, the anorthositic material. They landed in the dark Mare area, then drove their rover. This time they actually brought a car with them, and they drove partway up the slopes of Mount Hadley Delta and we're actually able to, for the first time, retrieve some of this really ancient crustal material. Apollo 16 was the first mission to actually land in the rugged highlands of the moon. Very, very different than the mare material that had been explored previously. And then Apollo 17, the last of the Apollo missions, was the first and only mission to actually carry a trained professional geologist to the moon, Harrison Schmitt. And when they got there, they went to a crater, Shorty Crater, that they had reason to believe from images might actually be volcanic rather than an impact crater. But when they got there, they discovered that it was, in fact, an impact crater after all. A little bit disappointing, but then Jack Schmitt looked down their footprints on the edge of the crater, and he saw something very strange. He saw soil that was orange that had been kicked up, and they started raking it, and they saw a great deal of orange soil below. And it turned out that that impact crater had exposed much older material that was indeed volcanic. This orange soil ended up being little beads of volcanic glass that had been erupted in a fire fountain long ago. And Joe and I have had the pleasure this week of taking Apollo moon rocks and some of that orange soil into the classrooms here in Hilo. So there have been a number of other landings. Of course, the Russians had robotic landings on the moon. And China has been landing on the moon recently. They just had the Chang'e 4 mission be the first landing on the far side of the moon. And there have been some things that have happened since Apollo that have been noteworthy. Back in the 1990s, we had two probes, Clementine and Lunar Prospector, that gave us preliminary evidence that there might be water ice at the poles of the moon. Now, about half the people who looked at the data said, yeah, that looks like water ice. And another half of the people that looked at it said, nah, I don't think so. And a great debate raged. And it became clear that the only way we were going to really be able to solve this was to sample it. But how could there be water ice at the moon? Well, it turns out, on the surface of the moon, near the equator, the sun shines straight down, and it gets very, very hot during the daytime. But at the poles, the sunlight comes in horizontally. And if you have a crater at the pole, the sunlight will just go right over the rim. The rim will shade the bottom of that crater. There are craters near the poles of the moon whose floors have not experienced sunlight in over a billion years. And because they are so dark, they remain very, very cold. These are the coldest places we have yet found anywhere in the solar system, even colder than the surface of Pluto. And so it stood to reason, if ice was going to accumulate anywhere, this might be a good place to look. The problem is it's really dark. So a little over 10 years ago, we devised a wonderful pair of missions. It started out with LRO, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, that was going to go into orbit around the moon and map it in unprecedented detail. Turned out there was some extra carrying capacity on the rocket, and so the Lunar Crater Observation and Sensing Satellite, LCROSS, was born, a secondary payload that flew on the same rocket. And we launched together on June 18th, 2009, and I'll admit right here to a whole lot of bias as I talk about these because I was intimately involved, fortunately, in the LCROSS mission. I had the great pleasure of working with some of the most brilliant people I have ever met, and I lived and worked this mission from the initial proposal all the way to the mission closeout. God, was this fun. So we launched aboard an Atlas V rocket from Cape Canaveral. If you were sitting here in Hawaii that day, you probably heard me screaming there in Florida. And the whole concept, this was brute force lunar exploration. The idea is after we got into orbit, we had left that first stage of the Atlas V, plopped it in the ocean, And we fired the second stage, something about 2 metric tons, about the size of a school bus, but moving at 5,600 miles an hour, considerably faster than your average school bus. And we used that upper stage to take us out of Earth orbit and on our way to the moon. Now, normally, once you leave Earth orbit, you take that for that upper stage, that second stage, and you throw it away. But this time, the LCROSS spacecraft, after we had shed LRO and it went on its own way to the moon, we held on to that upper stage. And we carried it with us all of the way to the moon. That got us away from the moon, and then we used it to do our excavation. So we launched 4 days to get to the moon. We used the moon to slingshot us up into a highly inclined, big, what we call Algolro orbit, lunar gravity system, lunar return orbit, that ended up bringing us directly into the south pole of the moon after roughly three months of orbiting. And we came straight in. And as we approached the moon, coming right in toward the south pole, we turned and aimed that big upper stage at one of the permanently shadowed craters at the south pole of the moon. We released it, fired our retro rockets to pull away, and we watched as that big upper stage went speeding down into that crater at 5,600 miles an hour, slamming into the ground, blasting several hundred tons of material off the ground, out of the shadows, into the sunlight, high into the sky of the moon. Then our little spacecraft dove down through that cloud of debris, sniffed it, analyzed it. And 4 minutes after the Centaur hit, we hit. Mission over. 4 really busy minutes. But by flying through that debris, that's how we, in fact, discovered water ice on the moon. And we now realize that there are immense amounts of water ice at the moon. Hundreds of millions of tons of water ice. Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter is still in orbit around the moon today, returning incredible data about the moon, giving us views of the moon down to less than half a meter in resolution. Really incredible. It was able to measure the temperature inside those permanently shadowed areas, and again confirm that it gets down as low as 248 degrees below zero Celsius. That's really cold. And it confirmed the existence of widespread ice at the lunar poles, not just in the permanently shadowed craters, but even in the areas outside that sometimes get sunlight. Down beneath the ground, there's apparently areas of permafrost. The sunlight comes in at such a low angle, it does a very poor job of heating the ground. And it has a wonderful camera, as I mentioned. Here we're looking at the Apollo 14 landing site. You can see the descent stage of the lunar module on the right. You can see some of the instruments that they left behind on the left. And the dark lines in between are the footprints of the astronauts. Yeah, we really did go to the moon. Some of the other spacecraft we sent up are the GRAIL, the twin GRAIL spacecraft that studied the interior structure of the moon. LADEE, the Lunar Atmosphere and Dust Environment Explorer, that studied the very tenuous atmosphere of the moon. And these are all leading up to our next great adventure, Artemis. Artemis is our program of returning to the moon with robotic explorers and with humans. In mythology, Artemis was the twin sister of Apollo, the goddess of the moon. With the Artemis mission, our plan is to send the first woman and the next man to the surface of the moon. They're going to the south pole of the moon. Some good reasons, because, yeah, we have water ice there. We're very interested in that area. Also, in terms of their areas of near perpetual sunlight, that could be very useful to us in terms of power. The horizon goal is sending humans to Mars. There are a number of key components to the Artemis program. One is the new Orion spacecraft, designed to carry a crew of 4 astronauts beyond Earth orbit. It's a bigger version of Apollo. It will include 2 main modules, the command module built here in the United States, and the service module you see behind it, built by the European Space Agency. This is a collaborative effort. We're going to need a big rocket to do this. bigger even than our biggest rocket to date, the Saturn V, and that will be the Space Launch System, SLS. There's also a plan to have a small outpost in lunar orbit, the Lunar Gateway. This will have an orbit that can be changed as needed and provide access to wide areas of the moon's surface, as well as communications link to the far side of the moon. We're also employing a number of commercial companies. There are a number of commercial companies that are now setting up services for delivering payloads to the moon. And NASA will not be their only customer, but we will pay them to deliver various payloads to the south pole of the moon and to other areas of the moon. There are quite a few areas that we would still like to explore, even at low latitudes. Apollo only sampled a few areas. One of the things that will be delivered by this commercial landing services program will be the Viper rover. And this is a rover that is going to go to the south pole of the moon, and it is going to prospect for water ice. We know that there is water ice near the south pole of the moon. We don't know how it is distributed. Here on Earth, when you have a resource, one of the first things you have to do is prospect that. See how it's distributed. See what its accessibility is. See if it is ore-grade material. We know there's water ice at the south pole of the moon, but we don't know how usable that's going to be, how much work it's going to be to harvest that water ice. That water ice is important because that's water for us to drink on the moon. That's hydrogen, oxygen that can be dissociated into fuel, oxygen to breathe. But again, this is our fueling stop that will get us throughout the rest of the solar system if that resource turns out to be accessible. There are a lot of companies that right now are planning great things based on the accessibility of that water ice. We don't know some very basic questions, so we need to do the prospecting, just like we do here on Earth. So there will be two phases to Artemis. Phase one is going on from now and projected to go through 2024, which is getting the system up and running and having it actually putting humans on the surface. Then phase two, sometime in the 2028 timeframe, will be to step all that up and create a sustainable long-term presence on the moon's surface and in cislunar space, space around the moon. So we anticipate the Artemis 1 mission, which will be the first flight of the Orion spacecraft to the moon. There will be nobody on board. It will be an automated flight, but it will test the vehicle and make sure that it works. Artemis 2 will actually send humans into orbit around the moon. And then Artemis 3, scheduled for 2024, will actually land the first woman and next man on the surface of the moon. Interspersed will be some support missions that will actually accomplish the assembly of the gateway in lunar orbit. There will also be a number of missions to the lunar surface that will, again, help us ascertain details about the South Pole and help us explore areas beyond the South Pole that we are still very fascinated by. Another key component is the human landing system. And this, again, is going to be a commercial partnership. So you have a number of companies right now that are submitting proposals to develop human landing capability on the surface of the moon. This will be used by NASA, but potentially by others too, because there's great commercial potential if all this works out on the moon. And so we have a number of companies right now actively working on this technology. And again, the assembly of the gateway. Think of a small space station, but we're not really calling it that because it'll be inhabited intermittently. A lot of science to be done. by polar landers and rovers, but also in areas beyond, as I said, not at the poles. There are areas where you have localized magnetic fields, remnant magnetic fields that we'd like to study, strange types of volcanism, perhaps pyroclastic deposits that could be rich in water, learning how to do in situ resource utilization, how to utilize the resources on the moon to learn to be able to live off the land. So this is Artemis Phase 2, the later phases, that will develop and deliver the more sophisticated science and cargo payloads, bring in international partners to start building that sustained presence on the moon, and develop the technology and operations necessary for continuing onward to Mars. Because Mars beckons to us. Mars is an amazing world, very different than the moon. It has polar ice caps like the Earth. It has clouds. It has an atmosphere much thicker than the moon's. It has an atmosphere with clouds. We've even seen it snow on Mars. The snow evaporates before it gets to the ground, but Mars has volcanoes, and I mean volcanoes, big volcanoes. This is Olympus Mons, the largest volcano in the solar system, 25 kilometers tall, 624 kilometers across. This is huge. This is a big mountain. Mars also has a Grand Canyon, Valles Marineris. And when I say grand, I mean really grand. If we're here on Earth, it would stretch from San Francisco to Boston. Its walls are 8 kilometers tall. That's the height of the Himalayas. Like the Grand Canyon here on Earth, it's actually a network of features. But unlike the Grand Canyon here on Earth was carved by flowing water. This is far too large for that. This is a tectonic fracture, a great rift in the crust of Mars, probably caused by the immense mass of the giant volcanoes to the northwest, the volcanoes of the Tharsis Bulge, including Olympus Mons. Mars today is a complete desert. There is no liquid water to be found anywhere on the surface of Mars. But as you look across the surface of Mars, you see that that was not always the case. There are ancient dry riverbeds. There are ancient dry lake beds. There are shorelines, beaches, along what used to be the coast of a great ocean on Mars. We can see where these great rivers carved the landscape, streamlined the landscape. It's not hard to visualize here which way the water was flowing. Water flowed into a great bay here. You can see that opened into the great northern ocean on Mars. This is important because here on Earth, whenever we find liquid water, we find life. Even if it's in the boiling pools of Yellowstone National Park, even if it's beneath the frozen ice cap of Antarctica, even if it's in the cooling system of a nuclear reactor, wherever we find liquid water, we find life. And if Mars was once covered in flowing water, that gets us thinking, could there have been life there? And while there's no liquid water to be found on the surface today, we do have clues that there may still be liquid water flowing beneath the surface of Mars. So could there still be life on Mars? We may have our first clues. As our rovers have been driving around Mars, occasionally they get this sniff of methane. Here on Earth, methane is usually the result of biological activity. Now you can come up with scenarios where geology can produce the methane, but we're seeing this really interesting seasonal variation in the methane release in the Martian atmosphere. What is going on there? We don't know, but we need to find out. Here's a global view, and you can see the extent of that large ocean that once covered the northern part of Mars. But this was long, long ago, during essentially the first 1 billion years of Mars. But this all got us excited enough that we sent the Viking 1 and 2 landers to Mars to sample and see if, in fact, there might be life in the soil. And they scooped up some dirt, mixed it with water, and subjected it to a pair of experiments and got completely contradictory results. One experiment said, yep, there's water there. And the other experiment said, nope, no sign of water. There's life there. And the other experiment said, nope, there's no sign of life there at all. What was going on? Well, it turns out the soil of Mars is rich in a chemical called perchlorate. Think of bleach on steroids. It's very reactive. What we might have seen might have just been chemical reactivity of the perchlorate. But then again, the perchlorate might have acted as a mask if there was, in fact, life in that soil. So bottom line is our results so far have been inconclusive. Our first rover was the Sojourner rover of the Mars Pathfinder mission back in 1997. And this was primarily a technology test, a very small rover that it was remotely controlled over a vast distance between here and Mars. That worked, so we got more sophisticated. We sent up twin rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. Spirit arrived first. It was designed to last for 90 days. It landed on January 4th, 2004, and it kept operating until March 22nd, 2010. We got our money's worth. It landed in an area known as Gusev Crater, which is the large flat crater you see in the center here. And if you look, coming up from the south, you actually see one of those ancient river channels. And that water apparently flowed into Gusev Crater and created a crater lake. There are even some signs of a delta deposit where the Ma'adim Valley, the river valley, enters into the lake. Oh, and just north of the lake, you have one of those wonderful Martian volcanoes. So you had water, you had an energy source. My God, how could you say no to this place? So here is a view with our Mars Trek portal, looking up the Ma'adim Valley into Gusev Crater. And again, you can see the signs of material that might be a delta deposit there. Oh, this is looking too good to resist. I worked with the team and generated this view of what it might have looked like back when it had water. They were really excited about this. They kind of gave me the specs, and I thought this looked really good. So I decided to do another version. I had the whole area covered with forest, and they told me I'd gone way too far. Spirit landed near the Columbia Hills in Gusev Crater. And again, using our Mars Trek portal, you can follow its path of discovery and look at the various waypoints along the way. I discovered an area that was apparently at one time a thermal hot spring on Mars. Those types of things here on Earth are great places to look for life. Here's a view looking down on the Columbia Hills. You can see the path of Spirit in blue. You can see a bunch of other paths there too. Those dark paths. What in the world are those? Those are actually the paths of dust devils, where dust devils sucked up the dust from the ground, exposing the darker colored rock. And that ended up being really important, because as I mentioned, Spirit was designed to last for 90 days. It was solar powered. It had these solar arrays sticking out horizontally. But as it drove along, it kicked up dust, and that dust deposited on the solar panels. And as the dust on the panels got thicker and thicker and thicker, the power levels started dropping lower and lower and lower. And we knew that eventually we would lose the rover. And then all of a sudden, boom, the power levels went right back up again. What in the world just happened? A dust devil had gone over us. It was like driving through a car wash. We started calling these cleaning events. And they extended the lifetime of the rover dramatically. Spirit had a twin, Opportunity. Opportunity, again, landed in 2004, and it remained operational until June 10th, 2018. This was the Energizer Bunny of rovers. The Phoenix probe landed far to the north and tested the theory that perhaps right beneath the surface there would be large deposits of permafrost. And so it landed and it had a long arm and a big shovel at the end, and it reached out and scooped the ground, and barely there it was, ice right beneath the surface. Our latest rover, the Curiosity rover, landed in Gale Crater. It's bigger, more capable. This is the latest version of the rover, and it is still going strong today. Gale Crater is also a region that we realize at one time was filled with water. We see vast sedimentary deposits, flow features, and again, using our Mars Trek portal, you can actually follow along the path of the rover as it explores the floor of Gale Crater. Our most recent landing was the Mars InSight spacecraft that was designed to study the interior of Mars through seismology and heat flow measurements. And as a matter of fact, it just recently discovered the first active seismic zone on Mars. It has been measuring Mars quakes. Coming up next, we have the Mars 2020 rover, scheduled to launch this coming July. This is going to gather samples that we think might be of interest from the standpoint of biology, gather and sequester those samples and store them for a subsequent sample return mission. It's going to land in Jezero Crater. And Jezero Crater, again, is clearly a crater lake, and its western rim is breached by a river valley. Its eastern rim is breached by an outflow channel. But in that western rim, you can see a very clear delta deposit where sand and clay and all kinds of material gathered from a vast watershed was brought in, concentrated, and dumped on the floor of that lake. If you're an astrobiologist, this is the kind of mud pile you want to play in. This is all prelude to sending humans to Mars. Right now, we're looking at doing that sometime in the 2030s. So we had a meeting back in October of 2015 to try and figure out where the heck are we going to send the first humans to Mars. And we had this meeting with people making proposals, people from all over the world. And as a matter of fact, under the brilliant tutelage of a professor named John Hamilton, students from this very esteemed institution showed up there and made presentations for two proposed landing sites. Again, the goal was to identify these sites. We had something that we called an exploration zone, a concept that would meet certain criteria, engineering constraints, and meet scientific interest values. An exploration zone is a circle with a 100-kilometer radius. Within it, there have to be areas defined for landing, nice, safe, flat areas, for living. There's science regions of interest, areas that are of particular interest from a scientific standpoint, areas that are of interest for resource standpoint, because Mars is so far away, you can't depend on regular grocery runs from the Earth. Grubhub doesn't go there. We're going to need to be able to live off the land when we go to Mars. So having the resources is key. And so 45 proposals were submitted. We're getting ready to have round two this coming fall, and are looking forward to more proposals. Another call will be coming out soon. It was a thrilling experience, a lot of wonderful ideas, a lot of lively debate, rending of garments, gnashing of teeth. It was a lot of fun. Again, the objectives from an astrobiology standpoint: look for places where, for evidence of past or even present life, look for the chemical precursors of life, study the current and past climate of Mars, understand better the geology of Mars, and across it all, look at the role of water on Mars, now and in the past. Resource criteria, access to materials that you're going to need, We have to be between plus and minus 50 degrees of latitude. You can't be too close to the poles. It's really cold up there. You don't want to send the astronauts there. They will not enjoy it. We're saying, first round, we said less than 2 kilometers in altitude. Don't want to be too high. The tops of the volcanoes are not eligible. We want to have some atmosphere to be dealing with. That constraint may change. We'll see in the upcoming call. I don't expect it to get lessened. I expect the constraint might become tighter if it does change. You need to have nice level ground, slopes less than 10 degrees, and no real big hazards like boulders or areas that you can land in. And you don't want thick deposits of dust, because the dust blocks our view from orbit of being able to assess the mineral composition of the ground. We need to have relatively dust-free zones to be able to tell what resources we might have to work with. So as we go to Mars, we're going to face some really serious challenges. Long travel times. It takes 4 days to get to the moon, about 6 months to get to Mars. During that time getting there and coming back, and even while on the surface of Mars, you're going to be exposed to significant amounts of radiation. We don't quite have that worked out yet. But yeah, we've had people living aboard the International Space Station for long periods of time. But the International Space Station is orbiting inside the Earth's protective magnetic field. Once you go to Mars, you're leaving that behind, and the environment gets a lot nastier. Long periods of microgravity in transit, and long periods of reduced gravity while on the surface of Mars. And we still don't know how much gravity we need to be healthy. We know being in microgravity is not good for us, but how much do you need? Is 1/6 G enough? 1/3 G? Or do you need a full 1 G of gravity? We don't know yet. We're too far away for frequent resupply. We're really going to have to learn to live off the land. It's going to require a lot of learning. And then there's the whole idea of isolation. You're just a long way away. You can't have a normal radio conversation. You got, typically a good 15 minutes of delay time. It's going to be challenging. Here's where I'm going to put out my caveat. And what you're about to hear may not be the official position of NASA, but there's something we really have to consider here. There are some people who think we should go to Mars right now. We can surmount any of those technical problems we just talked about. Yeah, maybe we can. Maybe we can't. I'd prefer to err on the side of caution. But there's something even more important here. Some reason you don't hear NASA talking about having 1 million people on the moon by 2050. Because we still don't know if there might be life on Mars. And if we just show up there, say, here we are, we're going to bring all our crud with us. And we could contaminate and potentially destroy a biological environment before we even know it exists. If there is life on Mars and it is different from us, or maybe it is even distantly related to us, both of those are really fascinating things. And in my opinion, it would be a crime against science to blunder there and destroy it before we are able to study it. But this concept of planetary protection works both ways. It is designed to prevent us from contaminating other worlds where there might be life, but it is also designed to protect us from bringing back something that might not be good for us here. NASA has an Office of Planetary Protection that puts forward very stringent rules upon us of sterilization and protection in a two-way mode. But it's not just NASA who's doing this. We can see in the future many countries and many private companies going their own. And so it is incumbent upon all of us to right now think about this, to take this question seriously. How will we as a society explore? Because we have wonderful examples right here on Hawaii and all around the world of what happens when foreign biologies sometimes clash, introducing pathogens and species from remote areas oftentimes doesn't work out really well. So I would suggest, in my own opinion, we need to be pretty damn careful here. But this is something that all of us need to think about. Because again, this isn't just going to be NASA doing it. Now, as we make these journeys to the moon and Mars, and as we all need to think about these issues, you can join us. My team develops a set of online data visualization and analysis portals that are used for mission planning, for planetary science, and for outreach. You don't need to install anything. You don't buy anything. They're all available just on the web. You can go online, and here we'll use our Mars or our moon portal as an example. You can zoom. You can pan. We'll pan down here to the crater Tycho. Let's zoom into it. Oh, look at that. One of the first questions you might want to know is, well, how big is it? That's very easy to determine. Calculating its distance is as simple as drawing a line. So we'll just draw a line from one edge of the crater to the other. And we see it's almost 84 kilometers across. That's a big hole in the ground. Another thing you might want to know is, well, how deep is it? And again, that's very easy to do. Again, we'll just draw a line. This time we'll extend the line on either side, include the rim. We can generate an elevation profile. Let's kind of move Tycho out of the way here. There we go. And now we can see how you can very easily measure the heights of mountains, the depths of valleys. It's a really neat tool. You can draw a bounding box around any terrain that you like. So we'll draw a nice bounding rectangle around Tycho here, and then it'll come back and it will ask us if we want an STL or an OBJ file for our 3D printer. You can 3D print any terrain you like. You can also jump into 3D mode, and just using the keyboard, standard game control keys, you can go flying interactively across the surface. We can fly down into Tycho Crater, and we can even go roving across its surface. One of the cool things you can do, too, is you can just draw a path. Use your mouse to draw a path anywhere you want across the surface. It then comes back with a QR code. Scan that QR code into your smartphone. Put your smartphone and a pair of cheap $15 Google Cardboard goggles, and whatever path you drew, you will now fly in virtual reality. This is just barely scratching the surface of the capabilities of what these portals can do. These are a lot of fun in classrooms. With that, I'll invite you to go to trek.nasa.gov. And with that, you can go to Mars. You can go to Mercury. You can go to our moon. You can go to Saturn's largest moon, Titan. You can go to seven of Saturn's smaller moons. You can go to the dwarf planet Ceres, the asteroid Vesta, and many more to come, including the near-Earth asteroids Bennu and Ryugu, Mars's moon Phobos. We got a lot of work ahead of us.